Welcome to Body Signals, a Cygnos podcast. I'm your host, Bill Tanzer, Chief Data Scientist here at Cygnos. This is Season 5, Episode 4, using CGMs and Cygnos to determine the when and why of eating. Join Alyssa Wilson and myself as we interview Dr. Michelle Jospy, a leading authority on glucose-guided eating. Specifically in this episode, we'll discuss Dr. Jospy's studies and their inspiration on several Cygnos tools and activities, including our fuel gauge and guess your glucose, how using a CGM can help you discover the when and why of eating, and the future of using glucose data to achieve weight loss and wellness. This and so much more on today's fascinating episode. Now on to today's show. Welcome back to Body Signals. We are thrilled to have our guest today. This is the first time we've had somebody from the Southern Hemisphere. We've got Michelle Jospy. She is a PhD from the University of Otago. She's also a registered dietitian. She works as a nutrition research scientist at Georgetown University, but does so from New Zealand. She's authored over 30 scientific studies, and according to many that I've talked to, she is the authority on glucose-guided eating. So, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. Very excited to be here.
And we're excited to have you. And as always, we have our favorite co-host, Alyssa Wilson. Alyssa, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. I've got to dive in, Michelle, on your background, because you have a fascinating background. I did some research before the show, had no idea when I had talked to you previously that you started as a graphic designer, then did like a year of rock climbing. And somehow in that trajectory, I don't know how it makes sense, you went into dietetics and got your PhD in nutrition, as well as your registered dietitian. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to take that journey.
You did some good research. So I've always been interested in both science and art, and I actually had a hard time deciding which route to go for. So I did study design, which was really exciting to study. Worked in Texas for a little while, mostly at hospitals, and really enjoyed my work in the hospitals, helping people. We were trying to basically help people navigate these enormous hospitals without getting lost with all the stress of cancer treatment and all these other things. But then was really into rock climbing, so decided to take a year off and travel all around Asia and North America rock climbing. And at that time, I was contemplating kind of my next steps in my design career, but I was a little bit ambivalent about whether I wanted to really be in kind of like the corporate world or kind of use that joy I found working in hospitals with patients. And so it's kind of, I know they don't seem related, kind of design and nutrition, but I think it's all about kind of communicating messages to people in different ways. So in nutrition, we all know what we should do. Like, we know we should eat vegetables and less processed foods, but I'm motivated by like arbitrary gold stars and charts, where someone else might be motivated by, you know, being able to play with their grandkids or having clearer skin or something like that. And I think design had taught me, or had kind of like fueled my interest in, how do we communicate things to different people? And then being a dietitian, I'm sure you know, Alyssa, it's all about, you know, communicating things effectively to different people. So yeah, completely changed trajectories, moved to New Zealand, and then started a bachelor's and master's and PhD. But I also just love learning, so it was like a good excuse also to go back to university for the next dozen years.
Well, I'm also a gold star on chart kind of guy. I don't know about you, Alyssa. Are you the same? Are you kind of gold chart?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. You could get me to do anything with a gold star or a free t-shirt. In fact, one of the stories I've told on the show is I rode a million miles on my Concept 2. Once I learned you get a free t-shirt when you hit that. I mean, the thing was just sitting there gathering dust. And as soon as I heard about the t-shirt, I'm like, I'm in. You're one of the few research scientists that we've had on the show. And I think we need to have more research scientists on, because you are really at the forefront of coming up with the theories and hypothesis and testing them and studies and learning all sorts of fascinating things. And I'm glad we had you on because you've had 30 scientific publications, a lot of them directly related to what we do at Cygnos. I'm curious, of all those papers, are there ones that you're most proud of?
I think behind all the papers, there's, you know, a lot of work that goes into them and different, lots of participants and different processes and stuff like that. I think the most pivotal one for me was probably the first one I did in my PhD, which was over 10 years ago. And that was the first paper with hunger training, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. And that was really interesting because we were taking this new and very strange concept and we were seeing if people would actually do it. And there was a real sense of curiosity, both from the researchers and the participants, like, will people do this hunger training thing? And then participant wise, like, what will they find or what will the experience be like? So it was really the start of kind of, you know, now I've published lots on hunger training, but it was really the first one just with 30 people. And we were trying to figure out the systems and again, how to communicate this method to people that made sense and that was engaging and not so scary. So that was pretty pivotal for me. And it was also like the first time I got this really interesting feedback about the method in terms of, I remember I had a participant who came up and she has said, you know, she had been forcing herself to eat breakfast for the last 45 years and she always hated breakfast. And through this study, she realized that based on her glucose, she didn't need to eat breakfast. And she felt absolutely like liberated from breakfast, even though like no one had been forcing her to eat breakfast, but just learning about her own body, she felt that she could be more confident about trusting her body and trusting her, you know, in this case, lack of desire to eat breakfast. So that was really, really exciting for me. And that kind of drove me to continue down this route of hunger training or glucose guided eating.
You know, the other thing I love about your background is just how you've mixed technology with dietetics. And I'm going to talk to you after the show about licensing your tagline that you use on LinkedIn, because I love it. You said, I help people use new technology to improve their nutrition. So I'm wondering if you tell us some of your favorite technology that you use in the world of nutrition.
Yeah, I'm a real technology optimist. Like I'm always really excited about stuff and like keen to, I guess, an early adopter. Well, glucose and CGMs for sure. I think that's really exciting and lots of potential. And then wearables like, you know, my Garmin watch and stuff like that. And I think that's been, while you might not think it's like directly relevant to nutrition, it gives you insights on the way nutrition affects your body. So for instance, I'm not a big drinker of alcohol, but on the occasional night that I have like a glass of wine, I had no idea how much it affected my sleep. And I would still have no idea because I can't sense it. But when I look at my Garmin watch and like see the quality of my sleep and how poor it is, consistently, even just after like one glass of wine, I think that's really fascinating. So the different wearables and biosensors, but I think also just the power of AI to turn all the data that we get from all these wearables, and there's going to be, you know, more and more in the future, and actually make, like you guys are doing, like actionable suggestions for people to do in the moment. I think that's really cool. And I'm really excited about that.
Cool. And I'm wondering, since you're on top of this, and also gadget geek like we are, mm-hmm. Whoop strap, Aura ring. I can't show the Cygnos because it's on my abdomen right now. There we go. Thanks, Alyssa. And we'll have to talk about wine because we've made some amazing discoveries about wine and glucose. But I'm wondering where you see the world of nutrition technology going in the next, like, let's say 5 to 10 years.
I think, first of all, there's going to be more and more biosensors. So in the field of biosensors, CGM is like 80% of the market. And I think we're going to get more and more of those as technology develops. And I think the CGMs will also become less invasive, even though they're barely invasive now, like you can't feel it. But I think they'll be even less so. I know in the sports world, like sports nutrition, there's looking at like lactate biosensors. So you constantly get your lactate thresholds or levels rather. And then I would love to see, and I think it's in development, of biosensors for like vitamins and minerals, and even talk about, you know, gut microbiome would be amazing to have kind of a much more, much less invasive way of measuring that as well. So I think the wearables and biosensor market will explode. But I think also the way that we interpret the data will change with, you know, generative AI and machine learning. And it would be really cool if we could take some of those insights and make behavior change easier for people. So say, you know, I find that like I'm low in iron, it could then suggest foods or recipes that would be high in iron, send those recipes or ingredients like to my local supermarket to like put in my cart, and then at home have some like, you know, magic kitchen device that just like whips it up. Like, I think the integration of all this would be amazing, just because it is so hard to sustain diet and physical activity changes, that if we could just make it a bit easier with technology, I think that would be really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, you're taking all this complex research and everything that you've done and, you know, translating this so that a person can actually change their behavior and become healthier. So what have you found to be, you know, the most effective way or the most effective tool to help the consumers help sustain that behavior change and taking that complicated data? I mean, what have you found?
Well, my work, goes kind of the opposite of what I was saying, but my work is a little bit different with hunger training, and we can talk about the details after, in that they wear a CGM for 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the study. And we really use it as a tool for them to learn to trust their body. So we're using it in a way that we then expect them not to use the technology. So we're kind of reteaching them to trust their appetite. So maybe I should just talk about hunger training now, because it might make more sense. Yeah.
But before you hit hunger training, I would love for you to give a history of it.
Yeah.
And there must not have been a marketer in the room when they came up with the name hunger training. So when you also talk about glucose guided eating, essentially the same thing, right?
It is. So it's had a few names. So it was initially called hunger recognition. And it was pioneered by Italian researchers, namely Mario Ciampolini, in Italy in the early 2000s. And they're the only group before us that kind of looked at this. And basically what they did is they took some strangely gastrointestinal patients. I don't know why. But they got them to learn to kind of guess what their glucose would be. And they used a glucometer, so they had to keep stabbing their fingers. So they got them to guess what their glucose would be before every meal. And then they were only allowed to eat if their glucose was under 85 milligrams per deciliter. And they measured like how long it would take for people to accurately guess their glucose. So most people were able to do it within 2 weeks. And everyone was able to do it, I think, within 7 weeks. And they found that people, when they ate according to like a low glucose, they ended up losing weight and improving their metabolic profile. So they did that in these people. And then we stumbled upon it, I guess it was nearly 10 years later. And then we kind of refined the technique further. And that was through the University of Otago. And now I'm with Georgetown and we're continuing doing studies. And the name has changed from hunger recognition to hunger training when I did it, which was really in like the Hunger Games era. And now it's called glucose guided eating, because I think hunger training was quite scary, but quite effective for getting participants.
Intimidating, but
yeah.
So those first studies, when they set like a hard limit,
yeah,
that hard floor of 85 milligrams per deciliter, that must have been pretty tough. And I think I remember reading some of these studies and it sounded like there was a lot of attrition, or people were just very dissatisfied with being told that they couldn't eat until they dip below 85. So did the future studies that you were involved in change that or make it a little bit more doable?
Yeah, so that was the first thing we did, actually. So that first study I mentioned was the first thing we did, was we thought, oh, there is no way people that everyone would have a universal cutoff of 85. Like, if you just look at the population data, like, that's not feasible. And so we made half the people do 85, and then the other half had like an adaptive threshold, like a threshold that was personalized based on their fasting glucose. And as you would expect, the personalized one was, you know, much more enjoyed by the participants, but it was also more feasible. And we actually put, it was pretty like old school CGMs at that time. I think they were like, oh, I can't remember if they were Medtronic, but they were the ones that just give you like 48 hours of data. And we could see how like it just wasn't possible for some people to eat ever, or like they could maybe eat like at 3 a.m. once or something like that. So we adapted it. And actually the people, it wasn't a weight loss study. It was just seeing the feasibility of this, but actually people with a more personalized threshold ended up losing more weight than the people with the really strict threshold.
Wow.
So that was the first thing we did.
In the early days, weren't they using a glucometer for the first few studies? So people had to do a finger stick.
Yeah. And most of my studies, they started off with a glucometer just because CGMs weren't as widely available. And then we did like a head-to-head comparison of a glucometer versus CGM. So half the people were randomized to stabbing their fingers and half CGM. Because we were worried that like maybe it was the stabbing and the pain and the fear of
That's what I thought. It's like aversion therapy, right?
Exactly.
If you want to eat, you got to stick yourself. So I'm not going to eat.
Exactly. But it turns out, thankfully, that it wasn't aversion therapy and that CGM was just as effective for changing behavior and didn't have the downsides of, you know, fear and this other stuff. So, since then, all the studies have used CGM.
Wow. I'm wondering how many studies in total have you been involved in that have looked at glucose guided eating or hunger training?
So we did that initial pilot to see that we like refine the method and have that adaptive threshold. Then we tested it in a really large randomized control trial with other kind of support strategies. Then I did a series of pilot studies during my postdoc. So we got some nurse practitioners to do it because we wanted to see how feasible it would be to integrate into what we call primary health care here. So like going to the doctor and the nurse would help you with it. We did a qualitative study, which was fascinating, like hearing people's feedback about this. And again, that head-to-head like glucometer versus CGM comparison. And then over to the US, we did a study in postmenopausal women at high risk of breast cancer. So adding it to the diabetes prevention program. And right now we are also doing it in another group of postmenopausal women with high risk of breast cancer, and also in a group of adolescent and young adult cancer survivors, since their risk of chronic disease is really high. And we want to see whether eating when your glucose is low is advantageous for your metabolism and then has flow-on effects in terms of reducing cancer risk. So a few, I don't know how many that was.
Right, a lot. I would love to, I'm putting you on the spot, but I'd love to hear like a summary of some of that qualitative feedback that you had gotten.
Because
that sounds fascinating.
It was so good.
What do people have to say?
So I think this comes back to your question, Alyssa, about like what makes it sustainable. And I think that a lot of the time it's like this discovery of how misguided or how unaware of their hunger they were. So people, when they are overweight or have been overweight, have generally like can lose their like response or like their inability to perceive hunger and appetite signals. So I get participants, you know, realizing that, oh, I thought I was hungry. But actually, I had one participant who thought she was hungry when she was full. Like it was the signals were completely crossed. And so she would eat a meal and then thought she felt hungry. So then would keep eating, but realized with the glucose that she was full. So that was super interesting. A lot of awareness of, emotional or eating because of their environment. So people would say like, I don't even know how I got there, but like I was standing in front of the pantry eating chocolate. Like I don't even know what happened, you know, or just becoming aware of all those times that they eat when they weren't hungry. Because part of hunger training is that you're supposed to rate how hungry you feel before a meal or also kind of what type of hunger it is. So is it physical hunger or is it emotional hunger or because people are around you, like social, or is it practical, like you have to eat it? You know, you're just used to eating lunch at 12 because you've always done that, but actually you're not really hungry then. So I'd have people people kind of got that concept really quickly. And I'd have people saying to me, you know, I started eating because I was physically hungry and I kept eating because I was emotionally hungry and stuff like that. So I think that's really interesting. And I think also people learning what meal patterns work for them. Like I was saying, you know, some people don't need to eat breakfast and are liberated from breakfast, and other people realizing like, no, I actually need to eat 5 times a day. Like that's what works for me. Else, like, you know, my glucose gets too low, not too low, but you know, low. Or other people realizing like, oh, twice a day is good for me. So some of that's good. But like the quotes were just amazing from participants.
Yeah, I should mention that for our Cygnos members out there, there actually is hunger training or glucose guided eating built into our app. Actually, Michelle, some of your studies were inspirations for us as we built. We have 60 different activities that our members go through, and we have things like a fuel gauge, and we actually have a guess your glucose task where we ask people to kind of make that mind body connection, and we blank out the glucose score and ask them to guess. So we do a lot of that. I'm wondering from all of your research, and I think you've even used a CGM yourself, if you have any tips or tricks you've learned along the way in terms of what works with a CGM if you're on a wellness or a weight loss journey.
Oh, wow. I feel like you guys would have a lot of tips and tricks yourself. I mean, mine has specifically been focused on kind of like initiating eating, because we've been looking at, you know, it's important what you eat, but it's also really important why and when you eat. So I think in terms of that, it's really checking in and pausing. And I think the measuring glucose enables that, of thinking, am I really hungry and why do I want to eat right now? And often, like from the qualitative study, often people are just thirsty. They realize like, I just need to drink water or a cup of tea or something like that. My experience from a CGM, I guess this is kind of going off from my studies, was quite interesting in that I found that meal timing had a big role in kind of how spiky my meals were. So like I could never get lunch to not be spiky, even like with a single piece of bread and like loads of protein and stuff like that. And I still want to eat carbs because like I run and I'm active and I do stuff and I need that energy. But the easiest solution was just going for like a 10-minute walk after lunch, which is pretty amazing. You know, like being a dietitian, you're like, I could figure it out. But like actually just going outside was the answer.
Yeah, I think the, you know, just with some of our activities and the glucose guided eating and the hunger training, I mean, I think that's freeing, just checking in with your own body and saying like, why am I eating? Just even asking yourself that question, you know, is it emotional? Like you mentioned, is it emotional reasons? Are we stressed? Is it bored? Is it routine? Like, are we happy, sad? What's going on? Yeah. And you know, there's food everywhere. Like when you're, you know, just at any store, you know, there's always food. There's, you know, so I think checking in has been so helpful. Like for me personally, in going through wearing CGM and going through our activities, and also like just being able to make that connection of looking at my glucose readings and like, how am I actually feeling when my glucose is a little bit lower, and am I hungry, or how am I feeling when it's higher? Just, I think that's so powerful, having that information. And like you mentioned, we're all different. Some people may not need to eat breakfast, 2 meals a day, a little bit more. So finding out what works best for you, and you know, having that data is so powerful. But the thirst and the hydration, mm-hmm. I find that out for myself too. And that's like one of my main goals, is to drink water, because I find myself thinking, oh, maybe I need to go to the pantry, but instead grabbing some water, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. For me, the other thing is being like a bit tired with my work, being in New Zealand and working in the US, like I have very early meetings. And often when I'm tired, I'm like, oh, I just need chocolate. But like, actually, I just need a nap. Like the chocolate's not going to be that effective.
Without the glass of wine, right?
Exactly.
So we can get some good sleep.
Speaking of the glass of wine and sleep, one of the things that we discovered, and we've covered this before in Body Signals, so I'll try and be brief, but we've noticed that when our members have alcohol, especially in the evening, that can delay, and they've had a carby meal with that, that can delay the spike for several hours as the liver's busy processing that alcohol. Digestion kind of slows, and then spike, instead of happening, you know, an hour or maybe even 2 hours after you eat, happens 3 hours after you eat, which then leads to disruptive sleep, which then can lead to all sorts of glucose dysregulation the next day.
So better to drink like at lunchtime.
Day drinking is preferred. Yes. Although in moderation. Yes. Always in moderation. Yeah. Michelle, I've got a question for you. Are there any pitfalls to glucose-guided eating? And I actually am thinking of one myself, just as I hear you speak. And I'd love to hear your comment. Sometimes I feel famished. I look at my glucose reading, and maybe I'm in the 130s. And I try and ask myself, is this emotional? Is this stress-related? I can tell you for myself, it's usually when I haven't slept well the night before, and I probably have like a ghrelin surge and leptin's been suppressed or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you've noticed any pitfalls to CGM use and glucose-guided eating.
I guess it has the same pitfalls that, you know, using a CGM does in general. Like the sensor can be not that accurate occasionally, or it can be affected by stress or by like a hot shower or something like that, or other things going on. So I think you always kind of need to use a bit of common sense. I guess with hunger training specifically, if you go, and we would always tell our participants this, like if you're going like 6 hours without eating and your glucose is still high, like our bodies are really good, you know, generally if you're healthy, at regulating your glucose. So at some point your body is just going to release glucose so that your brain keeps functioning. And at that point, you actually might see your glucose go up. So in those situations, you know, you have to check into your symptoms, like your stomach's growling and you're genuinely hungry. Then you would just eat and resume hunger training like the next meal. Similarly, intense exercise can raise your glucose, even if you're hungry. And so kind of using common sense, like I'm really hungry. I just did like a hard workout. I'm going to eat anyways because I am genuinely hungry. The idea is to learn to trust your body and learn to connect those signals and not kind of blindly follow the CGM because we know it's affected by things other than hunger.
Yeah, I think that's so helpful. Yeah, no, that's so helpful too. And like even as our members are going through our activities within the app and starting to make that connection of how they're feeling. But maybe, you know, like if I just did a hot yoga workout and my glucose was elevated, you know, just like keeping those things in mind. So I think that's really great advice.
So Michelle, where do you think glucose guided eating is going? Since you're like kind of the inspiration for a lot of things that I've read around glucose-guided eating, I'm wondering where you see the future of this.
I would love, like in the dream list, I would love for it to be connected to, you know, some of the hunger hormones you mentioned, like ghrelin and leptin, so we could get a really good sense of what's happening in terms of someone's hunger and appetite, and also just more integrated into other data and other biosensors and using AI to generate more insights. In the more immediate future, like I mentioned, trying it out with other groups and seeing if there's an effect of hunger training beyond kind of weight loss, like looking at the effects on like risk of cancer and other things that, you know, there is a link between having high glucose and having a higher risk of cancer. And so if you can eat when your glucose is low, is that helpful for reducing risk of cancer and other chronic diseases? So I think that's kind of the immediate future. And then also, you know, we're developing an app to make it easier for people and less invasive sensors and all that kind of thing. So just we're continuing to refine the method and get feedback from participants and find different populations that it could be helpful for. And, you know, eventually we'd love to figure out like the mechanism which it works if it does kind of reduce chronic disease risk. Like, how does that happen in the body?
So I'm going to go off script here and I hope I don't put you on the spot. But as you're talking, I've been thinking a lot about intuitive eating. And I've even heard some intuitive eating experts say this whole CGM thing, it's kind of counterintuitive eating. It's really a diet. I think it actually aids. The CGM and glucose-guided eating aids to help you build your intuition and make it stronger. It's almost like helping you like grow a muscle. Do you agree or do you not?
Yeah, that's exactly kind of where I came to it from, of intuitive eating. And I've actually measured intuitive eating in my studies, like before and after. And people who do follow hunger training have an improvement in intuitive eating, especially, if I remember correctly, like a reduction in emotional eating, and they start trusting their body more to tell them what to do. So like something on the intuitive eating scale, for instance, would be like, how much do you trust your body to tell you what to eat or when to eat? And those measures improve with hunger training. And the whole idea is that, you know, we should all aspire to eating intuitively and trusting our bodies. But like I said, if you have been overweight or if you have been following diets your whole life, you've completely lost that trust. And so having
this, you know?
So having this tool to give you a little bit of help for a few weeks of saying, okay, you're feeling hungry and you are hungry. Like remember that feeling of that, or you're feeling hungry and actually your glucose is really high. So does that feeling differ from like the feeling of being hungry? So it's working as like this external guide, and telling you what's happening in your body. And hopefully you can connect that to how you're feeling. And that's what we found in our studies, that people are able to do that and learn from it. That's and even awesome. I should add that like in our studies, we've used it for say 2 or 4 weeks, but then we actually follow people up for 6 months or a year. So they have been without the glucose monitor for, you know, 5 months at least, or 11 months, and they still have maintained changes. Sometimes we get them to do other things, like do a little journal of like how hungry they feel and stuff like that, but only intermittently. So it's a pretty, you know, comparatively, like it's a pretty short training period to sustain effects.
So Michelle, I'm wondering what you're working on now. Is there anything you can share with us of what your latest direction is?
Yes, it's not all top secret. we're publishing a scoping review. So that's kind of like looking at, I think we've searched like 50,000 papers. We're publishing a scoping review that have looked at randomized control studies. So like the gold standard studies that have used CGM to change behavior. So namely diet and physical activity. That's just been submitted for publication. We found 31 studies, mostly in the last 3 years, probably like half of them were in the last 3 years. And interestingly, only 4 of them were done in people without diabetes. So the rest of them were done with people with diabetes. So it's a really kind of exciting new field. Like we're still learning a lot. And I think that, you know, companies like Cygnos, you guys already have loads of data on this. So like some sort of academic industry partnership would be quite helpful, I think, because you guys have so many people without diabetes already using these products. But in academia, in terms of like rigorous trials, there's not that many right now. So that is hopefully going to be published soon. And then in the meantime, we are looking at the results of those studies to see like, as a whole, does using CGM improve diet and physical activity and also other health outcomes like HbA1c and weight and all these other things. So we're just doing that now. And then I've mentioned that we're also using glucose-guided eating or hunger training in these different populations. And these studies are running out of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. So if you're interested, you can join our study and live in Washington.
And speaking of that, if people are fans like we are of you, like Alyssa and I are of you, where can people find out more about you and what you're doing?
Luckily, I have a very distinct name. They can find me on LinkedIn, and feel free to kind of reach out if there's any academic papers that you'd like me to share. I'm happy to do that.
Awesome. Well, Michelle, it's such a pleasure having you on Body Signals, and we hope to have you on again to talk about your fascinating research.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Body Signals. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to our feed. Also, please share this episode with your friends. For those of you who are not yet Signos members, go to signos.com, signos.com, and use the code BODYSIGNALS, all one word, to get your 15% discount on Signos. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode of Body Signals.